I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff. Her career in journalism spans more than four decades, and she was part of the first female anchor team to helm a national news broadcast. We'll talk with Woodruff about some of the historic events she's covered, about how she and her team decide what NewsHour viewers need to know, and we'll get her take on what journalism should strive to be in the era of viral video, nonstop information, and fake news. Our conversation starts after a short break. Judy Woodruff once identified three qualities every journalist needs to do the job well: insatiable curiosity, concern about the world and the people in it, and the ability to never take no for an answer. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, live today from Hammond Hall at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. Woodruff developed her early fascination with political science into a career reporting on politics, first the Georgia State Assembly, then as an NBC correspondent traveling with the long-shot Georgia governor who ran for president in 1976. After Jimmy Carter won, Woodruff was promoted to White House correspondent and, in fact, was serving as the pool reporter and standing just a few yards away the day Ronald Reagan was shot. She first worked for PBS in 1983 when the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour announced plans to expand daily broadcasts to a full hour. 10 years later, she moved to CNN, where in addition to reporting and anchoring, she also moderated multiple presidential primary debates. She returned to PBS in 2006 to helm the multimedia Generation Next project, and in 2013 became part of the first female team ever to co-anchor a national network newscast along with the late Gwen Ifill. Judy Woodruff today is sole anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, and I am delighted she could make time to be with us today. Judy, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you very much. It's great to be here. It's great to be back in Dallas. Great to be talking to you.
So you grew up a military kid, is that right?
I did. I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dad was in the Army, lived in Tulsa about 5 years, a few years while he was overseas, and then we moved overseas to Germany, lived there for a while, came back to the U.S., lived in New Jersey, Missouri, back to Oklahoma, then we were in Taiwan, then North Carolina, and then Georgia. So seven schools by the time I was in seventh grade.
It's not easy to move around a lot as a kid, but it does make you very flexible.
Well, that's what they say. I don't know if my family would agree with that. No, it does. You have to. I mean, I had a very mixed set of feelings about it, excuse me, as I was growing up, because on the one hand, I was getting to see different parts of the world. I was making new friends. But then after a year, I was giving up those friends. And I remember having long, tearful, you know, sessions, crying to say goodbye to my girlfriends and guy friends, leaving, even in first grade, second grade. I mean, you remember those things. But it does make you adapt. You have to, when you land in a new place, you've got to meet people, make friends right away, and establish connections, or else, you know, why are you there?
How did you end up choosing a journalism career rather than politics?
It really was happenstance. I mean, I started out in math, but I had a professor in my freshman year in college who frankly didn't think women should be taking calculus.
Wow.
And so I happened to be at the same time taking a wonderful course in political science. Woman professor who got me very interested in politics, changed my major, thought I would work in government, got a job in Washington working for my congressman from Georgia. But after two summers, the women I worked with on Capitol Hill said, don't come back to Washington, because this was the late 1960s, because women aren't taken seriously. You're not going to be treated seriously. Think about doing something else. Go someplace else. So I went back to college my senior year, you know, kind of falling. My dream was falling apart. And I had a professor, political science professor, who said to me, do you ever think about covering politics? And that's literally how it happened. I mean, I started thinking, okay, well, if that's the way it is in politics, journalism is another way in. Of course, I came to find out that in journalism, you know, there still were not very many women back in the late 1960s and early 70s. But by that time, it was too late. I had fallen in love with reporting and with journalism, And that's where I stayed.
The newsroom that you lead today is unusual in that you have more women on staff than men.
We do. It is extraordinary, and it's never been that way for me throughout my career. It's when I started out, the news director, when I was a secretary at a station in Atlanta, in the newsroom, and I said, I really want to go out and cover, I want to watch the crew, watch the reporters, see what they do. And he said, why would you want to do that? He said, you don't want to be a reporter. And I said, yes, I want to be a reporter. He said, we already have a woman reporter. So, you know, that was the environment, that was the climate. He said that with a straight face. I mean, it was not a, you know, he wasn't trying to be cute. And it was just that way. But at some point along the way, women reached, I won't say parity, but certainly, you know, we've come into our own in journalism. There are more women reporters, more women producers, more women behind the scenes, making editorial decisions. Not enough, I would argue, but more. But, you know, at the NewsHour, and I'm really proud to say this, we have made it a priority to try to make our newsroom look as much like our audience, the American people, as we can. And we pride ourselves on that diversity. I've got a great core of correspondents who are supporting me, supporting our work every night. Half of them are women. And then behind the scenes, we've got a lot of great men and a lot of great women. So it's a diverse workplace, and we think today in 2019, 2020, you have to have a diverse workplace in order to reflect the country that you're reporting on.
Is it fair to say that your first big break was covering the Carter campaign? Would you define it that way?
I would say probably. I mean, when I covered Georgia politics, I covered the state capitol. I covered the first governor I covered was a man named Lester Maddox, who owned some of you may have heard of him. He owned the restaurant and was known because he wielded his pickaxe. He was a supporter of segregation, openly a supporter of segregation. That was my first experience in politics. And then along comes Jimmy Carter, who was considered to be more moderate. But yes, I would say in terms of national, I was determined I was going to get to Washington one way or another as a reporter. Once he was elected, I was already at NBC, and I lobbied them. I said, I know this man. I know the people around him. Of course, you know, at that time, NBC already had reporters who were standing in line with more experience. I mean, every news organization has people who paid their dues. They've been there. They want to cover the front runner. So, you know, in a sense, when I had to wait my turn, when they sent me to the White House, I was number three, clearly, on the totem pole. I had the morning shift and the weekend shift to report for the Today Show and the weekend news shows, and gradually work my way up.
What are your most vivid memories of the Carter campaign?
Well, I don't even know where to begin. Spending the long weekend and end of the week at the Best Western Motel in Americus, Georgia, which was 10 miles down the road from Plains, Georgia, population, I think, 300, and waiting, you know, coming in, you know, trying to be on top of the news, trying to talk to the people around Jimmy Carter, but also, you know, knowing that the one place you could go for a cup of coffee was, you know, the grocery store there in Plains. So I have very vivid memories of that and bonding with the other reporters. I mean, we were all, every presidential campaign has a camp-like feel to it because you are thrown together with a group of reporters who are in the same boat you are. You're staying in a hotel or a motel somewhere. You are up very early in the morning. You're working till late at night. There's no, and every day is different. You don't know what the candidate's going to do. You are, if you're traveling with them, or if they're, as we were in the case of Jimmy Carter, he was, of course, traveling all over the country. But I made some of my great, great friends in journalism. Johnny Apple with the New York Times, David Broder, the late, both of them now deceased, Johnny Apple, David Broder, and others, who really were icons back then. I got to know them because I was a brand new reporter with NBC, and they were, you know, they were who they were.
You met your husband on that campaign, right?
I sure did. You've done your homework, Chris. It was 1976. Carter was looking like he was going to win the nomination, but we hadn't had the convention, the national convention yet, and Jimmy Carter liked to set up these softball games between the press corps and his staff, which sounds like a great idea, except that his staff always had the Secret Service playing for them. So guess who won every single game? Carter would pitch. I call him Carter, President, you know, then candidate Governor Carter would pitch. And we would be there, you know, sort of scrawny, ill-fed. Some of us probably had stayed up too late the night before, had too many beers or something. Whereas the Secret Service showed up in great shape. They'd done like 25 laps around the city that morning. And we lost every time. But Al showed up, my husband Al Hunt, who's a journalist, was then with the Wall Street Journal and was covering one candidate and another. This was, as I said, in the summer. So we knew Carter was going to be the nominee, but the race wasn't over. He was running against the sitting president, Gerald Ford, and Al showed up, came out on the softball field, and I was playing second base, and our mutual friend Eleanor Randolph, who was then with the St. Petersburg Times, she then went on to be with, she's now at the New York Times, works on the editorial board. She introduced us, and that was it. But we didn't start going out until about 6 months later, once Carter won. And see, if Jimmy Carter had never won, I wouldn't be married to Al Hunt. I mean, and I've frankly told President and Mrs. Carter this, that they're responsible for our family.
What are the pros and cons of a two-journalist relationship?
Well, there are a lot more pros than there are cons, but I'll start with the cons. One is that when you go into journalism, you're committed to doing to a story no matter how long it takes. And that means sometimes when we were either going out together or after we were married, we both were working long hours. And so it would be tough. I mean, we would be away from each other working on something. We ended up having three children and very dependent on wonderful childcare. But it's a strain at times because your schedule, it's not like you know your partner is always going to be there at home at night. That may be the night when some story is breaking on the Hill, something's happened at the White House, and so you're constantly juggling. On the good side, though, you understand the highs and lows of journalism. You understand how the thrill of getting a story right, breaking a story, having something that you're really proud of, that you feel you've really added to the conversation, you've added to people's ability to understand something, to people now understand an issue they didn't as much before. And you can do that in different ways, but you get a real high from that. On the other hand, I had one of my favorite producers would say to me every day, "You're only as good as your last story, Woodruff," keeping us humble. Because you have to keep producing. I mean, you've got to keep doing good work day after day after day. You can't say, "Well, you know, I broke that story for you last week," or "I wrote that great column last week." You're expected to keep it up, of course. But there's a lot of pressure, and we love it. We thrive on it. We thrive on the adrenaline of journalism and getting a story right and adding to people's understanding. But you're pushing, and it helps to be married to somebody who kind of knows those peculiar ups and downs.
Did you have to have rules about sharing information when you were working on the same story?
I have a great story about that. We kind of had an unspoken rule that we would never tell each other. If we were working on the same thing, I was covering the White House when Al was covering the Hill, and then later on I went on to the Today Show and then to the NewsHour, where I was doing all sorts of things. I would occasionally be interviewing people on the Hill or people in the administration. This was Reagan and on to Bush and then, of course, Clinton and so on. And Al would be covering any one of those things because he was the bureau chief, he was working with other reporters, so he would know a lot about what the journal was working on. But I'd be trying to get an interview with somebody at a high level, say in the administration, and Al would somehow secret, he would let me know that person had already agreed to do an interview with the journal. And the best example was...
Let me jump in. We're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Judy Woodruff, anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes, and you can join us on Twitter at KERAThink or by emailing think@kera.org. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Judy Woodruff, anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. We're talking this hour about her career and the state of journalism in the modern era. You can join us on Twitter at KERAThink. So you left us with a cliffhanger, Judy, before.
Well, I don't know how much of a cliffhanger, but you were asking me, did Al and I ever, was there ever a conflict? Because both of us are journalists in Washington. At the same time, probably the most interesting example was it was during the Reagan administration. I was covering the White House. We were in Santa Barbara. The president had gone out there for a week in the summer. And I really, really had wanted an interview with a budget director, a man named David Stockman, and had been calling and calling and calling. Unbeknownst to me, Al had already arranged to talk to Stockman off the record for a longer piece that the Journal was going to run after the budget deal, which was down the road. I wanted to talk to him for now. So we're staying, Al, we had rented this house and, you know, near wherever all the journalists were staying. Phone rings one day, and I pick it up, and it's David Stockman calling. And this is after I'd been trying to get my phone calls not being returned, even his secretary wasn't calling me back. And I said, oh, you know, Director Stockman, I'm so Judy Woodruff. He said, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. You know, I'm calling because your husband and I are supposed to talk on the record. Okay. So then I had to close the door, leave the room so Al could have, this is back in the day before cell phones and all the rest of it. But, you know, I gave Al a really hard time about that for a long time.
So one of the things you did as White House correspondent during the Reagan era was occasionally serve as pool reporter. For people who don't know what that is, can you explain what the assignment entails?
Well, when the president travels, there always is press with him. And if it's a venue that can accommodate a lot of people, they'll have all the press go along. But for the travel, the vans, the cars that follow the president when he's moving in a motorcade, it was in Washington that day, we were going from the White House to the Hilton Hotel, they pick one network, one news organization will write for print, one news organization will cover for television, another one for radio, usually maybe a wire service too. But it's just to skinny down, to minimize the number of press who are following right immediately behind the president. Doesn't mean other press won't be there at the venue when you get there, but we're the ones who are the body watch, for lack of a better term. That's what it is. And so, yeah, that's what I was doing that day.
So you were the pool reporter the day President Reagan was shot.
I was the television reporter. NBC, it was NBC's turn to go with the president. He had a speech before a labor union group at the Hilton, and he had gone in, heard the speech. We were rushed outside before he came out, so we were in position at this sort of a canopy driveway with a canopy overhead. And so when he came out the private door, I was standing there yelling a question along with other reporters. I think I was asking, somebody asked me later what I was, it was something was going on in Poland Lech Walesa, basically what would turn out to be a political revolution in Poland. But the president came out and we're yelling, and then we hear the pop, pop, pop. And I'm about 25, 30 feet away. I'm just on the other side of the car. So we didn't know what was going on. We heard the sound. At first, it sounded like firecrackers, but of course, nobody would be shooting firecrackers off with the president, and it quickly became clear. People were screaming, Secret Service was saying down, and before we knew it, the car went away. We had no way of knowing initially whether the president, in fact, they didn't know that the president had been hit, as you all know, but his car pulled away. They gave us a split second to decide whether we were going with the motorcade to follow him, which normally would be what you would want to do, except that we had just witnessed a shooting. I could see Jim Brady lying there. I could see a policeman. Turned out there was another law enforcement, Secret Service, who had been hit. And so we I had to make the decision we all did about whether to stay, and I stayed, and then had to find a telephone. This was 1981, March 30th, 1981. Run from building to building around there to try to get on the phone to report on what had happened. It was a reminder that, you know, not that you ever, ever take your job for granted, but never to relax for a second in that position. I think there's no question in my mind that the security around the president, it was secure then. It's even more secure and more of a cordon today, if you will, around the president even than we had then. I mean, there were clearly Secret Service agents and a lot of security, but today it's even far more secure. There's just a lot more precautions taken today than there were then.
For anybody, witnessing a shooting at that proximity is traumatic, but you didn't have time to sort of explore your own feelings about this. Can you talk about what it takes to compartmentalize in that situation?
You know, I don't know where that comes from, but you're right. I mean, you use the right word, Chris. It's compartmentalized. You have to, because I saw Jim Brady, who I knew was the president, the newly elected president's press secretary, someone I knew fairly well, lying on the ground. I could tell that he had been hit. There were people hovering over him. And you didn't know what had happened to the president. All I could do, I ran to a phone, was on the radio for NBC describing what I had seen, and then essentially spent the rest of the afternoon standing on a chair. I got in a taxi with my producer and went back to the White House, which was, you know, 10 minutes from there, and spent the rest of the afternoon standing on a chair in the briefing room while the country and the press corps tried to understand what had happened to the president. As you know, right away, we didn't know. They diverted to the hospital on the way back to the White House when the president said, I think I was hit. But they didn't know that till they got in, you know, they were in the car and on the way. But it's I can't say that it's something you learn, but you know that you can't bring your personal feelings into your reporting. I mean, we're human beings. We react, but we can't let it overcome and overtake the work that we're doing. There have been other examples of that. I mean, I was in the studio the day 9/11 happened. I was at home and then drove in quickly into work. By this time, I was at CNN and was on the air all afternoon, was watching as the towers came down. I wasn't in New York. I was in Washington. But you just learn that you have to internalize it and deal with it. You're a human being. You can react. But you can't let it take over your ability to do your job. But having said that, have I ever been emotional? And sure, I mean, there are stories I've covered, stories I've watched unfold on a screen in the studio when I've been anchoring that have affected me emotionally. But in the end, I'm there as a journalist. And I think you bring your humanity to that, but the journalist piece of you has to be present at all times.
You also kept working throughout much of the time that your son was recovering from brain damage that happened after a surgery that went wrong. He was just a teenager at the time.
That's right. Our son Jeffrey was born in 1981 with spina bifida, a relatively mild form of spina bifida. And then when he was 16 years old, there was a surgical mistake. And he came through that, but very, very seriously disabled. And so I took 6 weeks or more off. I was at CNN then. I took 6 weeks off, came back part-time, and worked part-time through the end of that year. It was 1998. It happened to be the time when President Clinton was dealing with the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So the press corps in Washington was in a complete uproar over covering that and the unfolding investigation. I came back to work that December, the week of the House impeachment hearings. So you can imagine what that was like. It was coming back to this huge, momentous story with all, you know, I don't have to say, enormous consequences, but also having dealt with, you know, what we were dealing with. And I pulled myself together. I mean, I think it's, I can say that there was one doctor in particular that kept me strong through that whole thing, because at one point I said to him, I said, this is such a life-changing experience, not just for Jeffrey, but for our whole family. Maybe I shouldn't go back to work, because, you know, I need to be here for him. And he said, there's only so much you can do. You need to go back to work. You need to, you know, find your footing, because, you know, there's only so much you can do. And we've found a balance in our family. It's clearly a life-changing thing for any of you. We've all had experiences in our own families that have changed us, and you come through it, and you're broken in the broken places, but you're stronger in some ways, too.
You didn't know initially what the rest of his life would look like, what he'd be able to do. Do you remember the first time you heard him speak after?
Oh, yes, because I had gone back to work as a part-time at CNN 2 days a week, and he was in the hospital in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, and my husband and I were taking turns being with him. And the day that he spoke was one of the days when I was in Washington and my husband was there with him. And so Al put him on the phone and I was at the office. You can imagine, I just couldn't hold it back. He said something like, Mom, I'm okay. But it was a journey. It was a tough journey. He's doing much better today. He's still quite physically disabled. He lives in a supportive community near Washington. And in fact, I was just with him yesterday. He had an appointment at Hopkins that I drove up to Baltimore to be with him yesterday for a couple of hours. But he comes home a lot, comes home for weekends, and we see him a lot. But he definitely has a challenging life, a challenge for the rest of his life. And what's happened to him has shaped our family. There's no question that we're all, I think, much more aware of certainly disabilities, what that means for families, and frankly, how our society needs to do a much better job of accommodating people with disabilities and making sure they have the same opportunities that all the rest of us do. I think we still have a lot of work to do in that regard.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So you and Gwen Ifill were the first women to co-anchor a national newscast on a regular basis. Can you talk a little bit about the dynamics of that partnership?
Well, Gwen was a force of nature. I mean, all of you who ever saw her on television, ever saw her work, know that she was just somebody really special. Incredible intellect, incredible sense of humor, a people person. I mean, she loved and, you know, the thing I remember most about Gwen is the big, you know, bear hug. When she would greet friends. I was very lucky to get to know her well before we worked together. We were friends before I rejoined the NewsHour in 2006. But we were correspondents together, and then after Jim Lehrer retired, they asked us to co-anchor. And we were a team from day one. I mean, we decided, I told this story, actually I spoke at her funeral, and I told the story about how Gwen and I decided after we were asked to work together, that, you know, we said a lot of people are going to look at this and think, okay, white woman, black woman, you know, there's this racial difference, you know, do they really get along with each other? Two women, are they rivals? How do they? And we decided that nobody was going to get between us, no matter what. We were going to stay as close as we could. And you know what? We did. It was the summer of 2013. We were already good friends, but it was completely natural that we were then very close colleagues. And it was and we covered the Washington in the, what can I say, in the 13, 14, 2015, and then of course the 16 election. And then Gwen died just not even a week after the 2016 election. And it came on very fast. I mean, we knew she had a diagnosis of cancer, but we didn't. We always thought she was going to come through it, because she just was this, you know, forever strong and surviving person. But it was, we had a special friendship and a special professional working relationship that I think gave us an ability that I think made the program better, because we were able to work together so well as a team. You know, it's not always easy in this crazy journalism world to, you know, to make it work exactly right when you put two people on the air together. But, you know, I try to, you know, we used to talk about how Jim and Robin always got along together so well. We were going to get along even better than they did. And they were great pals and continue to this day to be very close friends. But it was a huge loss, an enormous hole in my heart and all of our hearts. We miss Gwen. We miss her a lot.
I remember reading accounts at the time, people asking members of your staff how everyone was doing, and people, more than one person said, Judy Woodruff is keeping this place afloat. Was it something that you thought about really deliberately, like that you needed to sort of be the standard bearer for how you would get through this loss as a team?
I thought it was really, really important for people to know that we were going to carry on in a way that Gwen, you know, would have valued, that the values that Gwen lived as a journalist, values that I certainly share as a journalist, that those were going to continue to be the values of the program. She, as I mentioned, she passed away just a few days after the election, so we were dealing with a new president in Donald Trump, a different president, someone who would not come out of a traditional political background, and of course somebody who was a controversial figure. And I was determined that we were going to just keep straight ahead, focused on the work that we do as journalists, and not get carried away with any kind of an agenda. I think it's been easy, and we can talk about this, Chris, it's been easy since the election for, given the attacks on the press, it's been easy, I think, for some journalists and journalist organizations to, in essence, get into kind of a contest with the president. I don't think, personally, I don't think that serves us well. It certainly doesn't serve the NewsHour well. It's not what we do. We think the most important thing we can do is pay attention to the stories that we cover, cover them as thoroughly and as well as we can, and not think of ourselves in relation to what the president is saying about the press every day. It's not to say we condone that. We are not enemies of the American people. We are not fake. We are working just as hard as we can every day to get the facts, to get to the truth to the extent we can know it, but to try not to focus on that and make that a central focus.
My guest is Judy Woodruff, anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff. We're talking about her career and the state of journalism in the modern era. Judy, it seems like every event in America these days is sort of parsed through the lens of politics. Is that something we should be concerned about?
I think we should, because politics is important. It is how decisions get made that affect all of us. But we have become a very partisan, this is a partisan moment, time in our country, and a polarized time. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation about that. I think, you know, debate has always been healthy in this country. That's what our democracy was founded on, the ability people can express opinions and disagree, and we work it through, and then we keep trying to get to that more perfect union that the founding fathers wrote about and talked about. But when you get to a point where everything is seen as either on the R side or the D side or the left or the right, and there's just not space in the middle for conversation, you know, I think you lose a lot. I think you jump, I think often I'm talking about all of us collectively, jump to conclusions. We say, well, that, you know, if you see somebody say that or do that or wear that, then they must be X or Y or Z. Or if they say or do something else, they must be in the other direction. I would hope that we would be more thoughtful about it than that, because I recognize in the social media time that we live in, ideas, opinions are flying past us at the speed of light, and you can barely, you're barely understanding that one thing has happened when the next thing comes along, and you're kind of knocked off your feet, and so you feel like you have to make a decision, you have to make a value judgment. I would submit you, maybe you don't, you know, just hold off for a minute, take a deep breath. You don't have to weigh in. But I recognize I'm an outlier when I say that, because there are a whole lot of people, you know, Twitter survives on opinion, and so much of the rest of the social media that we swim in right now. But I mean, it's one of the reasons that the NewsHour to me is a place that stands apart in many ways, because we can take the time, an hour a night, and think about. We have all day long, and more than that, because there are stories that are weeks in the works, and sometimes longer. But we have time to think about, okay, what matters today? What do we really want to talk to the American people about tonight? Is it the Virginia dispute over what happened with the governor and, you know, photo of blackface, Ku Klux Klan costume in his yearbook, and now we learn that the Attorney General of Virginia, you know, also participated in dressing up in blackface. The lieutenant governor has a sexual assault allegation. You know, that story has completely blown up, or stories. So how much attention should we focus on that? How much attention should we focus on the fact that the president said during the State of the Union this week that he wants to end HIV/AIDS in this country by 2030? Well, we did end up doing a segment on the latter last night, because we thought, I mean, not only has William Brangham on our staff spent a lot of time doing research, and he's traveled around the world reporting on it, but also because it is worthy to just stop for 4 or 5 minutes and reflect on it. And so William did a little background piece, and then he interviewed a couple of experts on HIV to talk to them about whether it's realistic. Can we really put an end to this terrible disease that we've done a pretty good job in this country, but not as good as many people think? I mean, there's still inner cities across this nation that are still struggling with that. And on down the list, I mean, we spent last night looked at the North Korea nuclear talks. It would have been easy to slide past that because there was no big development, but we thought, you know, for us, if the president can truly come to some deal, some agreement with North Korea that gets them to reduce and potentially eliminate their nuclear arsenal, which, granted, that's a long way off, a lot's got to happen between now and then, that's significant for the world. We spent, you know, I had Nick on, debriefed him for 4 or 5. So every night, every day, we're thinking, what really matters today? What do people need to know about? What are they maybe not hearing about anywhere else that we may be able to add some light to? And that's the other thing, Chris. We're thinking about how do we add light, not so much heat every time. Doesn't mean we never want to have an argument. We're happy to have a healthy debate on when it's appropriate. You know, Friday nights with Mark Shields and David Brooks, sometimes they disagree, actually, and we get them on other sides. Sometimes they are in surprising agreement on whatever it is we're talking about. But it's a series of judgments that we make starting the day very early. We have a morning meeting, and we go through the day, and we're constantly tweaking and changing, trying to get the best guests that we can. I've been reading the emails today on guests that they're trying to get tonight to talk about. There's an environmental segment that they're working on. And sometimes you just don't get the guests you need to have the conversation that you think is going to advance the story. But you just keep trying, you keep trying, you keep trying. Every day is a whole new, it's like a blank slate. You're going to write on it again, and then you come back the next morning and you've got to do it all over again and all over again. It's one of the reasons I love journalism so much.
The president has made no secret of the fact that he often thinks he's covered unfairly by the mainstream media. I wonder if you would say he's been covered differently than his predecessors.
I would say he's been covered differently, but I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he presents differently from other presidents. Again, here's somebody who had never worked, had never been elected to office, never been appointed to office, came directly out of a business and show business background, television, reality show, and obviously had been interested in running for president for some time. He started exploring it back in the 1980s, running for president, but didn't announce until 2015. A lot of people didn't take him seriously. He didn't, and he'd been a Democrat not so very long ago. So for the Republican Party, he was someone they didn't take seriously. So you had somebody who was really landing in the political maelstrom, if you will, without having any experience in that, in Washington or in a state capitol. And he brings his own very strong personality, very strong set of views, and his willingness to criticize people who don't agree with him. And that includes if he sees a news story that doesn't reflect his point of view, he's going to be very, you know, happy to criticize the reporter and the news organization that wrote it. Now, the president himself would say, and I've heard him say this, you people are unfair to me. You don't ever give me credit for what I do that's going well. And he cited, in fact, the North Korea negotiations. And there may be something to that. It may be that the press holds him to a little bit of a different standard, but I don't think that's a big enough explanation for what's going on. I think so much of what is happening is the press is trying to understand what this president is doing, trying to explain it, but also, you know, we cannot ignore the investigation by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. We can't ignore the questions that have been raised about cabinet members who ended up leaving office, an unusual turnover at the White House, and the president's own controversial statements, the tweeting that he does. There's just so much more material coming from him, spoken, written, tweeted every day that, you know, we pay attention to that at the same time we pay attention to whatever else is going on. He makes himself the subject of, I think it's fair to say, more news stories than any other president I've ever covered.
Do you think his style of communication, which is hyperbolic, sometimes plays fast and loose with the facts in service to what he sees as the sort of larger truth, if I can understand correctly, do you think the way he communicates will change political discourse permanently?
It's a very good question. And by the way, I don't know why or, you know, where this comes from. You asked if it is, you know, is it because he thinks it reflects his larger view of ground truth. I don't know that. I don't know what the motivation is. But I do know that there are statements that are made and tweets that are tweeted that have to be corrected because they're not factually correct. Not all of them, but a number of them, and that is part of our role in the press to make those corrections. But I think it's a very good question. Is the next president, whoever he or she may be, are they going to enjoy this kind of adversarial relationship? There's always been an adversarial relationship between the press and the President of the United States. Our job is to hold public officials accountable. That's what we do. But are we going to see this kind of daily conflict, combat? I would think perhaps not. I think there's already kind of an exhaustion factor that's setting in. I think a lot of people are, you know, just don't want to read every day about the fights that are going on in Washington or the disagreement, the argument. And maybe people are going to be tired of that. But it's, you know, hey, this crystal ball is kind of cloudy right now. I can't tell you what's going to happen. We've got an election coming up in November of next year. It's only, 22 months away? 22 months is 22 lifetimes in American politics. We don't know who's going to be running. We don't know who all of them. We know some of them. We don't know who the nominee is going to be. And, you know, watch this space.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, I'm curious as to how, as particularly on the Democratic side, you have large numbers of people either officially declaring that they intend to run or making it clear that they would like to be talked about as if they intend to run. What's the process at the NewsHour for gaining context on these individuals and the kinds of campaigns they intend to run and then providing that to your viewers?
Well, we're just now gearing up and doing that in terms of understanding. First of all, we want to know who's running. There are a number of people who said they're not running, who we thought might be. But the ones who've announced, who've either created an exploratory committee or they've jumped in full time, we are building research on them. We've already posted on our website, the five things that Elizabeth Warren believes, or, you know, five of the things that Elizabeth Warren believes, or here are six things to know about, we haven't done Bernie Sanders yet because he hasn't announced yet, but Pete Buttigieg, I'm going to be interviewing him next week, who's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. A lot of people don't know who he is. He's got an unusual name. He's written a book. He's running for president, apparently. He's created an exploratory committee. But there are so many more. Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York. I mentioned Senator Warren, Senator Harris from California. Amy Klobuchar has said she's got an announcement to make in the next few days, the senator. It's fascinating to me that the first announcements have come from women and people of color in the Democratic Party. It's a really interesting turn. We have not seen this kind of diversity in our presidential candidates ever in our history, and what we're seeing right now.
What will determine how much the American public gets to know about the contents of the Mueller investigation when the report is complete?
I think a lot depends on our knowing that. And what we don't know yet is how much access we'll have to that report. There's some concern that when that report is finished, that it will be filed away somewhere and it won't be made public. I personally think the odds of that are unlikely, just because there's such a strong desire to know what they've worked on after all these months of looking into so many different things. But I would also say that, we're now looking at the investigations coming out of the Southern District of New York, the district attorney in New York, looking into more of the president's business dealings. There's going to be a huge amount of interest in those investigations and grand jury investigations and whether they go anywhere. So you're going to be looking at the Russia investigation that Robert Mueller and his team are pursuing, as well as these others. They're going to roll out on a different timetable. The latest information we've had, Chris, is that the Mueller report may come out as early as the next month or so. So we'll see. But the press is going to be pushing very hard for the American people to know what's in that report, for all the attention to that, for all the indictments and findings that we've heard about so far. What does it add up to? What's in there? What do we need to know as American people?
Judy Woodruff is anchor and managing editor of the PBS NewsHour. Judy, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you, Chris.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. You can use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast. And you can find out about upcoming shows at our website. That is think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.